Hello, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome back to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. We are back for season 3. Been reading a whole lot of books and can't wait to tell you everything I think about them. On today's show, I am going to talk about a book called Pinot Girl, a memoir, a family, a region, an industry by Anna Maria Ponzi. So I first actually became aware of the winery that this book is all about, Ponzi Vineyards, at the very beginning of my wine career, way back in 2008. One of the very first wine trips I ever took was to Oregon. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and it was to Oregon Pinot Noir Camp, OPC. If you're listening and you've never heard of this and you're wondering what wine camp is all about, well, it's a little bit of a rite of passage, and it was an incredible experience. And it was an opportunity for, and still is an opportunity for, young or old, really any sommeliers or folks in the wine trade to visit the Oregon wine community, specifically the Willamette Valley. And it was incredibly eye-opening, lots of different tastings and meals and events and getting to meet winemakers. And this was an introduction to the Ponzi family vineyards, as well as lots of other great Oregon wine producers. So I feel like I've been familiar with these folks for quite some time, but this book was a really fascinating deep dive into the family history and also the history of the Oregon wine industry. It's a really young compared to the United States as a whole, but also the world in terms of wine production. It's a really young industry, and this is an incomparable look into that. This episode is brought to you by Eldon Selections, an online Burgundy wine importer. Are you looking for a great red or white Burgundy that you might not find anywhere else? Eldon Selections specializes in small production, hidden gem Burgundy wines that are not otherwise available in the United States. You can visit burgundywine.com/somme. That's burgundywine, all one word, .com/somme to order. So this is a pretty new book. It was published in 2020, and that also coincidentally was the 50th anniversary of Ponzi Vineyards. The author, Anna Maria Ponzi, is the daughter of the founders of Ponzi Vineyards, Dick and Nancy. And along with her older brother, Michelle, and her younger sister, Louisa, this book centers on their family, their move from California to Oregon, the creation of their winery and the planting of their initial vineyards to essentially almost current day operations. She does say in the introduction to this book, and I think this is really cute, that this book draws almost entirely from childhood memories, keen eavesdropping, and lengthy tableside conversation. So this whole family enterprise started when she was quite a young child, you know, certainly even before she ever went to school. And she has moved on to be most recently the co-owner, president, and director of sales and marketing for Ponzi Family Vineyards. She's been involved in every aspect of winemaking, sales, and marketing for this winery. So she knows it like the back of her hand. So if you're searching for this book, just to let you know what you're looking for, it's like 5x7 and paperback. And Pinot Girl is just enlarged white typeface. But then there's kind of this like dusty lavender, kind of misty picture in the background of vineyards. So its background is Oregon wine vineyards. I'm sure those are Ponzi family vineyards, just with a typeface in front. So it's aesthetically pleasing book as well. This book is organized essentially in a chronology. It starts off in the very beginning when her parents are in California and her father was an engineer, and kind of details how they decide to kind of get involved or decide they want to make wine. The Ponzis, Dick and Nancy, they lived in Northern California in the Santa Cruz Mountains and just always kind of enjoyed wine. And even from before they ever entertained ideas of making it, kind of had this belief about wine that it was, well, like so many of us, the industry feel, it's something that's best shared amongst friends, shared with a meal. And that's just sort of how they thought about it. Now, just to give you a little bit of a time frame here, we're talking about the early 1960s. And so this is really, the wine industry in the United States obviously had quite a boom. Prohibition decimated almost all of it. And then if we think about, you know, the modern wine industry in the West Coast of the United States, like it didn't really exist in the 60s in Oregon and was really quite in its infancy in California. And there are a couple of kind of impactful events. And one of my favorite occurs just right in the beginning of this book. And her father's brother, her uncle, lived in Iceland. And the family decided to take a trip to go see her uncle Frank in Iceland. And it was, you know, an exciting time. Her family, by the way, her grandparents were Italian immigrants. And so wine is, you know, it's a part of the culture for lots of Europeans, but certainly for Italians. But her uncle Frank lives in Iceland. And the story is really funny. He's part of this Italian family and has an appreciation for and affection for wine. But Iceland does not have the climate or the viability for planting grapes for making wine. There's no vineyards on Iceland. There's no grapes to purchase. But Uncle Frank cherished his greenhouse. And in his greenhouse in Iceland, he had an abundant supply of tomatoes and basils and a very aggressive celery crop. And that healthy crop became Uncle Frank's answer to making wine. Good wine. So at this point, Maria Ponzi, she's a little kid. She's, you know, probably being told a lot of this story. But essentially, Uncle Frank and her father were tasting this wine. Her father was very skeptical and was very surprised with actually how delicious a celery wine could be. In fact, he's quoted as saying, it's so aromatic and so clean. It's almost like German Riesling. And Uncle Frank and Dick Ponzi were talking about how you could actually make something delicious out of celery, humble celery, you know, as a vegetable. And Uncle Frank talks about a book that he had read, an important book called Guidelines to Practical Winemaking. It's a little paperback. And that just sparked a conversation between the two brothers and this idea that maybe there was a resource out there. And of course, the Ponzi's at this time, they live in California. Grapes were plentiful. You could buy grapes. And upon returning to the United States, in fact, that's what they did. They purchased grapes, read this book, and they made a barrel of wine. Now, I'll fast forward through some of the chronology, but they ultimately decided that they wanted to move to Oregon. And when they were moving in the family station wagon, took this barrel of wine, because it was still aging, with them in their station wagon and moved it. So they moved themselves to Beaverton, Oregon. And this is just outside of Portland, Oregon. Dick Ponzi takes a job working, I think, at the local community college, teaching mechanical engineering. And they build this really charming and well-described little kind of hippie country life there. It's important to note that at this point, there was, I mean, nascent isn't even the word. Burgeoning, not the word. Like non-existent is probably the right word for a wine industry in the Willamette Valley. But it was just something that they wanted to do. And they had kind of a ramshackle house out in the country. And it should be worth noting that this part of Oregon was mostly dedicated to other agricultural crops, cherries and berries and, you know, hops and apples and things like that. So there were plenty of farmers around, lots of dairy farmers, but nobody was growing wine grapes. And coincidentally, and one thing that kind of is a little bit of a string or a thread throughout this book is just the fortuitous kind of happenstance of meeting other people, all of whom went on to become pioneers of the wine industry. And so just early on in this book, talking about family conversations around the dinner table in their little farmhouse in Oregon, Dick Ponzi comes home and he starts talking about how this guy came into his office and started talking to him. And this guy's name is probably fairly familiar if you're at all familiar with the Oregon wine industry. His name is David Lett. And David Lett was classmates with another icon and pioneer of the Oregon wine industry, Chuck Corey. They were classmates together at UC Davis. And he just stopped in to introduce himself. And he had a vine, a nursery vine in McMinnville. And they ended up talking. And this lays the foundation for this group that eventually formed. They self-called themselves the Pinot Obsessed. And what's so cool about this book, and I should mention it's a lengthy read. It's like 350 pages. But throughout the entire book, just starting the very beginning, it's just these kind of really good chance meetings of like-minded folks who all just really liked Pinot Noir. And they all shared this outlandish belief that perhaps Oregon was the place that Pinot Noir could thrive. And they became friends. They all kind of lived out in the country and had farms. And there's just so many fun stories. In addition to just the founding of Ponzi Vineyards and how they were building it slowly, are these kind of discussions of how they would get together and share bottles of wine and food. And they all had this shared dream and they went on to really pioneer. But back to some of these childhood stories. So, you know, I've never made wine. I've spent plenty of time at wineries, but one of the funny things about this book, and it's not a comedy, it's not meant to be a comic memoir, but through the at least 2/3 of this book, Maria Ponzi's a kid. You know, she goes from young child to adolescent and then, you know, on through college and afterwards. But as cool and as romantic as forging your way in the wine industry and making wine sounds, I don't think it's that cool for kids. So much of this book, like there's her own thoughts are interjected along with her memories, like this sucks. I hate this. And she sounds like a grumpy little kid half the time, as do her little sister and her big brother. But they weren't given an option not to be involved. It was an all hands on deck type situation. It's really, really funny. Her parents were definitely in the vein of a 70s kind of family. Just, I can picture it so clearly. And depending on your age and where you grew up, you might not be able to picture it quite as clearly. But they had a farm. It was a working farm. Her mom felt very strongly about the importance of quality ingredients and quality food. So they had goats that they milked. They had cows. They had chickens. There was an actual garden that was planted. She made a lot of their food. And while Dick Ponzi had his day job at the community college. Nancy Ponzi was basically running the working farm and raising her kids. And there's some really funny stories that have absolutely nothing to do with wine, but more of, I guess, their parents is like kind of wacky hippies in the 70s. And they're just, they cracked me up. So her family, her parents have got this like cluster of friends, kind of fellow like-minded folks in the 70s. And there's this one chapter, again, it has absolutely nothing to do with wine, but it was so funny. I think I laughed out loud. The chapter, by the way, is entitled The Corpse, which might sound a little bit scary. Anyway, it starts off, death arrived at our door on a particularly cold day in January. It was Derek Down's idea. This is, by the way, their eccentric British neighbor, who had decided that it was time to butcher one of his pigs. And the Ponzi's thought it would be interesting to see how many parts of the animal they could make into products beyond traditional cuts of meat. Because you gotta love that approach where if you're going to, you know, you're gonna use all the bits. And so it became a big thing. Of course, the kids are all young. They wanted no part of any of this nonsense. So they basically hid out in their room and were playing Hot Wheels and Little People and things like that. But eventually Maria Ponzi ventured out to see what was going on. And her mom and one of her friends were at the sink washing something and stirring a big kettle and asked her mom what they were doing. And essentially her mom said that we're going to make soap from the pig's fat, which, I mean, if you ever read Little House on the Prairie, I mean, these are things that you can make soap from animal fat. However, she describes this as saying, for the next several months, we were forced to clean ourselves with pig body wash. This so-called soap was more like a lard scrub. Its lava-like surface was painful when I rubbed it against my tender skin. It was completely void of any lather or scent, and I would toss the slightly used bars into the garbage can whenever I could, hoping to exhaust the supply. But each morning, another would mysteriously appear. There was always one in the tiny closet shower and another one at the hand sink. Hundreds of these dreadful bars remained in our home for months. And then, of course, her little kid response is, why can't we buy Dove like normal people? I love Dove. I want Dove. Like, I'm dying. Because again, nothing to do with wine whatsoever, but it really endears you to the author and like really just drives home kind of like her parents' aesthetic and the angst of a small child who just wants to blend in even more so when she's a teenager. And then her parents are making pig fat soap and thinking about using the pig's teeth to make earrings. And it's just it's a hot mess. Slowly through the years, they start to expand. And one of my favorite actually wine-focused chapters is when they actually start to plant a vineyard. So just a little bit of background on how this actually works. So you don't plant grapevines from seeds. You need cuttings, either from another vine or from a nursery. And as I mentioned, there was a fortuitous meeting between David Lett and Dick Ponzi. And I should mention that that meeting led to the purchase of 90 Pinot Noir vines. And so they've got to plant them. And at this time in Oregon, like I said, there wasn't a wine industry. And so much throughout this book in the formative years was, you know, the second or third or fourth hand acquisition of some sort of farm equipment that was used for something else. A lot of communal sharing of equipment, because again, everybody was kind of striking out on their own. And when it came time to actually plant these vines, they started off with just a nursery row, just one row that were planted just to see how it would go. And they had remained healthy throughout the year. So her parents, the Ponzi's, decided it was time to actually plant a vineyard. And the exciting thing is that the valley was home to all kinds of other farms, including bean farmers. And apparently all of the bean farmers in the valley had switched out their pole beans for bush beans. So instead of being harvested by hand, they could be harvested by tractor, which meant that all of the grapevine farmers, including Dick and Nancy Ponzi, could score cedar end post for bean poles and the wire for free. And the post could be scored for 2 cents per post. So obviously costs have changed in those years, but this is a really thrifty endeavor. And so they get these posts, they get the free wire, and they've got to plant the vineyard. At this point, Maria Ponzi is like 5 or 6 years old. But you know what? She was not too young to be taught how to drive a tractor. And this kind of takes me back because there's always memes and stuff around this now about, I mean, I don't have children, but I remember what my life was like as a kid when oftentimes you were shoved out of the house and just told to go play, right? And the door might get locked and you'd go ride bikes with friends or you'd go, I don't know, you'd make up your own fun. And that's basically what the Ponzi's did because they kind of lived out in the middle of nowhere. They had to make their own fun. They would go, you know, playing in the woods or hiking around and making their own fun. But then they also got called in to work in the family business. And, you know, she was barely big enough to reach the pedals, the gear shift. And of course, the wheel was really big and heavy. But, you know, if you can reach the pedals, you're old enough to drive, I guess, as the saying goes. And so Maria Ponzi learned how to drive a tractor, not well, but she was expected to be involved. And so there's a really endearing chapter called, in fact, The Tractor, where she, and this is, you know, it's a manual, there's a gear shift and she's got to depress the clutch and the brake and the gas. And can you imagine doing this, like having your kindergartner do this? Like it would seem crazy now. You might maybe even get into trouble for doing that with your kids now, but times they were different then. Times were, you know, they were innocent and they were fun. So that was just a big project, very exhausting project. But from early, early on, these kids were involved in every aspect of building a winery. Some of the stories are a little bit more heartbreaking than others. Again, grumpy kids not wanting to be involved. And they slowly, you know, it takes the grapevines a few years before you'll actually get a crop that you could consider making wine out of. So this is a long game. So planting a nursery row, it's healthy. The next year, then they actually start to plant vineyards. And then they've got to wait for the vines to actually get big enough where they could ever consider having a harvest. And then it details when the grapes are actually harvested and the actual winemaking. And again, secondhand equipment that comes from other places. And all throughout this, the Pinot-obsessed group continues to meet. It starts to incorporate other icons of the Oregon wine industry like Myron Redford or Dick Erath or Richard Summer. And so if you've spent, you know, time in the wine industry, if you love Oregon wine, these names are not mentioned like these big shot celebs. These are just like her parents' friends who would like come over and hang at the house and like help her mom and dad out with their ventures. And also her grandparents, I should mention, also got roped into helping her parents out with their adventures in Oregon wine development. One thing that's interesting to note is all these folks, Dick Erath, David Lett, Dick and Nancy Ponzi, these 10 or so passionate individuals who are all kind of part of this little Pinot-obsessed group were actually the original members of the Oregon Viticultural Development Committee. And so they actually ended up helping write and get past some of the legislation that would eventually go on to define what made Oregon wine so great and so spectacular. So this group, this Pinot-obsessed group, they became part of the Oregon Wine Growers Council. And eventually, and I should mention at this point now, David Adelsheim has been brought into the fold. So again, all of these notorious folks from the Oregon wine industry. We've moved into the 70s at this point, and they started to talk about having some legal designations for Oregon wine. And it's so interesting to hear this talked about because it had never been made there before. And so they wanted to be really honest and really straightforward, but they also wanted to separate Oregon wine out from other wine industries, notably California. And so the discussion centered around things like in California, people might be appropriating names of other fancy winemaking regions like Chablis or Burgundy. And a lot of these winemakers, Lett and Adelsheim among them, had definitely brought back cuttings from vineyard area in Europe. And they were quite familiar with these famous regions of wine production. And they insisted that they shouldn't call their Chardonnay Chablis. It should be called Oregon Chardonnay. They shouldn't call their Pinot Noir Hardy Burgundy. It should be known as Oregon Pinot Noir. And everybody agreed. And this sounds like really basic, right? But this is actually pretty revolutionary at the time. And so they set about how they wanted to define Oregon wine, because not only did they have a passion for producing it, but they also wanted to protect it and hold everybody up to a high standard. So in 1977, ORS 471 passed. This is some legislation that basically mandated that all Oregon wine should be made from 90% of the labeled variety. And so by doing so, at the time in 1977, 44 years ago, they created the most restrictive labeling laws in the country. It was intended to dissuade others from reducing the integrity of Pinot Noir, and it strengthened Oregon's unique position in the marketplace. Now, you know, if you're studying for a wine exam or something like that, you might, I don't know, face a question. I know I did. And I certainly spent a lot of time memorizing the different labeling requirements for if a wine is labeled by a state or if it's labeled by a county or an AVA or a single vineyard and what percentage of the stated variety has to be in there, depending on how it's labeled. It does vary. And it also varies in different states have different requirements. And Oregon has some of the most restrictive in the country. Just FYI. Now you know who to thank for that. It's not a big portion of the book, but you know, this book is written by Maria Ponzi, and I should mention, I'll talk about it at the end, but her sister goes on, she ends up becoming the CEO and the president and the director of sales and marketing. Her sister, Louisa, went to viticulture school and vinification school in France and ended up taking over winemaking duties when her dad retired. And so oftentimes, you know, especially around International Women's Month, people always get really fired up talking about women and wine. I do too. Don't get me started on it. But historically, for lots of reasons, which we won't go into in this podcast, the wine industry has long been dominated by men, not just in the United States, but around the world. And Ponzi has been, in recent years, obviously a woman-owned and woman-run winery by these sisters. And there's a really kind of great history of the women in the Oregon wine industry and just how responsible they were for, you know, the success of the industry. So, of course, I mentioned David Adelsheim, David Lett, Myron Redford, Dick Erath, Dick Ponzi, all these guys, right? Well, one thing to keep in mind is that their wives, their partners, their girlfriends, they were all equally involved. This was an all hands on deck thing. And Maria says that she really felt that while most of the men continued to work on perfecting their wines, they might have had to maintain their day jobs to support the families. A lot of the women in the Oregon wine industry at this time were responsible for sales and marketing, and really their contributions became more and more and more important, especially getting the word out about these wines outside of the local area. Nancy Ponzi was, you know, she was the one who would load up cases of their wine in their Datsun station wagon and drive it into Portland and make presentations to sometimes very snooty and obnoxious sommeliers who wanted, in Portland, Oregon, nothing to do with local Oregon wine. They only wanted French. But she really was a driving force behind marketing not just their own wines, but Oregon Pinot Noir on the whole. A rising tide lifts all boats. And that was definitely sort of the high, I think, on everybody's mind. And so she had these great ideas. And when they were first starting, no one had tasting rooms. This was an unknown area. And now, like, you can't go to wine country without stopping in tasting rooms. And so there's great detail about how they would operate, you know, a little tablecloth covered table in their winery, and it became their first tasting room. And these wine women of Oregon had these great ideas about how could they build up tourism to the wine industry? They weren't in a metropolis. They were kind of out in the country. And so they thought, what if we create like a passport where a visitor gets a stamp at each winery? And if they visit three tasting rooms, they can take home a logoed wine glass. Like, we take this for granted now because you can get a logoed wine glass anywhere. But they were just trying to come up with any idea of like how to get people out there. And of course, the rejection and the objection that they dealt with in many cases was hard not to be defeating, because people would want Cabernet Sauvignon or they would want sweet wines. They were unfamiliar with Oregon Pinot Noir and they didn't understand what people were doing. And of course, at Ponzi, they were only making dry wines. And so sweet wines have been and long will be popular with a lot of people, but they really believe sort of in this European model where they were making, you know, gastronomic wines, wines meant to be paired with savory food, not just desserts. And so that disappointed a whole lot of people. Getting someone to drive out to your farm, to your tasting room was hard enough, but this was all driven by Nancy and her cohort. And Maria says that she felt there, the women of the Oregon wine industry, that their work was even more significant since most married women at this time lost their birth names and identities to their husbands. For example, my mother was recognized as Mrs. Richard Ponzi. This is how a married woman would sign a household check, completely abandoning her first and maiden name. She was also unable to access bank information or apply for a credit card without her husband's consent. By quietly taking control of some of the business demands, the women felt valued, but it was no small feat. They worked behind the scenes often, swallowing pride when they were expected to draft important letters, only later to be told their signatures wouldn't be necessary. Men still handled all the important details. But her parents were a team, and this was just, you know, something that her mom could do. And they were both absolutely, completely necessary to work together. They had a really very holistic approach to everything. But I think it's important, and I'm very glad that she includes that, because kind of the silent labor of women, I think, sometimes gets forgotten. And further on, there's a lot of details about how Nancy Ponzi, while Dick Ponzi was making the wine, Nancy Ponzi was getting it out there, and how she was searching for a distributor outside of the Oregon area, and how she submitted their wines into contests. And of course, her husband got the recognition for being the winemaker, but it was she who got the New York Times wine reviewer to review the wines. It was she who was writing the letters and sending the samples. So it really was a collaborative effort, but it's really important to know that it was not just the winemaking that made this winery everything it is. Some of the stories, you know, like that story about the butchering of a pig is horrible. And I can only imagine the nightmare of having to use pig fat soap for months and months. But then there's other sad setbacks and things that happened. I mean, it was a difficult place to grow grapes and make wine. One of the things, her brother was never quite as involved in the winery as she or her sister Louisa, but he was really talented musician. So they had this idea one year where maybe they could have kind of like almost like a festival out at the winery, and they could hire a jazz trio and they could charge people admission, and it was a cash only affair. It was, you know, $5 per person, and people could drive out and they had picnic kind of situation. Her grandparents were there helping. Nona, or grandma, you know, she's washing the glasses. Nancy cooked, and there was a grill outside, and they were grilling sausages, and the musicians were there, and it was just a big old party, right? Almost like a harvest party or something like that. And, you know, the lawn, the farm, everything was covered with people and picnickers, and everybody was, you know, enjoying Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and there was a line in front of the bar, and everyone's having a good time. You get to the end of this chapter, and Maria mentions that at one point she was in the kitchen or something like that, and she noticed that her mom was stuffing cash, because it was a $5 entry fee for the food and the wine, into a brown paper bag. There was no way to run credit cards. It was an all cash affair. And she probably had collected several bags full of cash that day, and she put all the bags on the kitchen table. If there was ominous music, you kind of know that something bad is happening here, right? Well, just like her Nona and just like Maria, Grandpa Charlie, who was, again, all hands on deck helping out, liked to keep everything clean. So Nona took care of the indoor space. Grandpa took it upon himself to manage the outdoors. And as the event drew to a close, he started an open fire in the back of the house to burn all the garbage. Don't come at me with the, that's how we get rid of our trash. We're dealing with something like 40 years ago. Anyway, once all the guests left, we all took trips to the burn pile, tossing everything onto the hot flames. I thought Grandpa's fire was a brilliant idea. So efficient, Maria writes. writes, "At the end of the evening, everybody's sitting around the table, cold glasses of water, talking about the busy day. It had been a huge success. More people had attended than expected. They sold out of sausages, they sold out of cheesecakes, and more importantly, they'd sold wine. Not just glasses, but bottles. And a few people even took home cases. This is huge because this book details like from before a tasting room ever was a thing for them to the fact that they're having like big, you know, big-ish kind of farm parties." And the following dialogue takes place. "How'd we end up, Nancy?" Pop asked, looking at Mom. "I was just going to get to that, but I can't find the bags." "What bags?" "I put all the cash in a couple of brown paper sacks and left them there on the table." There was nothing on the table. "Nona, did you happen to move a couple paper bags from the table?" Mom's voice was concerned. "Never saw them," Nona said. "Louisa, did you take the bags from the table?" "Nope, not me." "Daddy," Mom called out to Grandpa down the hall, "did you pick up a couple of bags when you were cleaning?" "I'm not sure. Everything I picked up just went into the fire." Mom looked at Pop and Pop looked at her, and we all knew what happened. The money had all gone up in flames. All the work from the day. The setup, the cleanup, the promoting, those wine sales, all lost. Cash was never put in a paper sack again, and we all kept a closer eye on Grandpa's roaring fires. Heartbreaking, right? It's just absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, if it wasn't clear, the fact that they were making soap out of, you know, a neighbor's butchered pig wasn't just for the novelty of it. Like, they were scrimping along for a long time, and to have this big success and then to have all of the profits burned inadvertently by Grandpa Charlie, heartbreaking. But I think it just kind of underscores like the trials and the tribulations and the struggles. And this was just not an easy time for really anyone. The book is divided into two parts. Part one is like 2/3 of the book, and it's really Maria's childhood and the founding of the winery. And throughout, it talks about how they slowly expand, how their little ramshackle house that they first move into, eventually her dad builds them a bigger house and they move from that. And how the winemaking, you know, for a long time took place in their barn. And then eventually they did build a winery. One cool fun fact that I never knew about is that the Ponzi's, as they were expanding their businesses, they actually opened a brew pub and a pizzeria in Portland, which is really cool. And of course, using everything, they were using the yeast from the beer making as starter for their pizza dough, which is not a novel concept anymore. A lot of places do that, but I had no idea. They've sold it. It's not part of the family industry anymore. But I was like, oh, how cool, how industrious, because there's a long running joke in the wine industry that takes a lot of beer to make wine. And I just love that the winemaking family also decided they were going to make some beer. I just thought it was really clever. Anyway, the kind of last third of the book, part two, is when Maria is a little bit older, and it talks, you know, how she goes to the East Coast and goes to college and is living out there for a while. And like many kids of vintners, kind of eventually feels the pull to come back to the family business. And she takes off before she decides to move home with her sister and does like a little bit of a gallivant and travel around the world. Louisa, her younger sister, eventually, and we're talking about the 80s at this point, eventually decides to go to winemaking school in France. And then they all kind of return home and take over the ownership of the winery. And so she moves, Maria moves home back to Oregon in 1991. And we kind of move into current times and how they have expanded it. And I will say they did receive a little bit of kind of pushback and flack, because not only is this an endearing story of, you know, a founding family winery of Oregon, but they became a popular winery. Their wines were reviewed and received good ratings. They entered their wines in competitions and sometimes they won, and they expanded their business. And hey, haters gonna hate, right? And so sometimes people viewed that as not necessarily selling out, but just becoming like, you know, too big to be whatever. I think that's a little bit of a precious view to take on wine. You know, it's great to be a winemaker, but if you're a winemaker who's not selling their wine, you probably won't be a winemaker for very long. It's a vocation. It was their family's source of income. You know, once her father was able to leave teaching his engineering jobs behind, I'm not one of those people that casts stones. I say good on you. They were a really huge part of developing the successful industry. There's a note in here that in 1975, there were 14 wineries in Oregon. This is before I was born. Teeny tiny industry, right? Just FYI, to put it in comparison, how this industry has grown as of 2019, which is obviously a couple years ago, it was nearly 1,000. So this industry has really grown. Not to say that it wouldn't have become anything without the Ponzi's and all of their ilk, but it's an important kind of backstory. And to be told in this memoir manner, I think really lended so much insight and humor. And it's just, I don't know, as a child, if any of you out there are children of the 70s or 80s, I think you'll get a real kick out of some of these memories, even if you didn't grow up on a farm in wine country. So if I go back to what I was talking about in the very beginning, I first became familiar with these wines when I went to Oregon Pinot Noir Camp. And one of the nice things about taking these trips and getting exposed to different producers and different wines is that then me as a sommelier kind of in the beginning of my career, would go back to the restaurant where I was working in Washington, D.C., and I discovered some new wines, and then you can put some new wines on your list. And so one of the wines I was particularly fond of, and of course, this book is called Pinot Girl. It's the Oregon Pinot Obsessed, but they grow other grapes at Ponzi. You know, they grow Chardonnay, and one of my favorite wines actually they produced is from an Italian white grape called Arnais. And Arnais is this little white grape that is originally found in the Piedmont region of Italy. And it's just a really charming, really delicious wine. Some of my favorite producers of Barolo or Barbaresco also grow an Arnais. And because the Ponzis are an Italian-American family, it seemed appropriate to grow Arnais. And so this was one of the wines that I really, really liked. And I added it to the wine list at the restaurant where I was working. And for context, this was, you know, 2008. And again, Oregon wine, even then, in the beginning of the 2000s, was still largely unknown by a lot of people. To the point, having nothing to do with wine, but another Ponzi name was in the news at that time. And late 2008 and 2009 is when Bernie Madoff was arrested and charged with financial crimes and fraud and his Ponzi scheme. And of course, God love DC, me putting the Ponzi Vineyards wine on my list, I would get people who were unfamiliar with the wine, but actually questioned me and thought I was putting it on there as like a dig or a nod at like the current events of what was happening with Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme. That's not why I put it on there. The wine was delicious. It still is. But I think that was kind of a testament of where the clientele in DC were dialed into in terms of like news and crimes and financial crimes versus Oregon Pinot Noir or Oregon wine industry, I should say. So that's always kind of cracked me up just a little bit, but every wine I've tasted from them is really fun. And look, you know, I don't put out pairings for these book reviews, but sometimes it's a no-brainer. And so if you're looking to sip along and read this book, you obviously know exactly what you should be drinking. Now, it is important to point out something. So this book was published in 2020, which is the 50th anniversary, crazy, of Ponzi Vineyards founding. By the way, the book also talks about other names they thought of to come up with their winery, and eventually just decided on their family name, which I think was a good call. But in April of this year, of 2021, something pretty momentous happened with Ponzi Family Vineyards. So the family behind Bollinger Champagne, they actually purchased Ponzi Vineyards. This is the first acquisition of a U.S. winemaking property, and the purchase included the winery, the tasting room, and about 14 hectares of land in what is now known as the Laurelwood District AVA. This is a pretty recently delineated AVA. So that's a pretty big deal. This is not the first instance by a long stretch of a famous French winery or winemaking family purchasing vineyard property or a winery in the United States. There's a long history of this, I should say, because if you think about France, and so much of wine growing regions in France are fully planted. There's no expanding. I mean, there might be some, but there's not a lot of room to expand. And so one of the options is to expand around the world. And there are great examples of producers who have expanded into Oregon as well. And so this is pretty exciting. Now, some kind of details about that purchase. The Ponzi family retained 40.5 hectares, which is like 100 acres of vineyard land. And they will continue to grow and sell grapes to the Ponzi winery and vineyard, which is now owned by the Bollinger family. And they have a long-term contract established. So Maria and Louisa, they're still being retained. I think they kept on all, if not most, of their staff. So they're still involved, but they've transferred ownership. And maybe it seems a little bit less romantic. I don't know. I love Bollinger Champagne, so I'm pretty cool about this merging of sources. You can have your great Oregon Pinot Noir, and you can have some great Pinot Noir dominant champagne as well. One thing to remember with books is that even the most recently published books, it's a static thing, and the world of wine keeps evolving and keeps changing. And so there's no mention, obviously, of that in this book. I'm sure they were talking about that deal before this book was published, but obviously the ink was not dry, so it couldn't be mentioned. It would be if there was a sequel to Pinot Girl, or if the book was made three chapters longer. I think that probably would have been an inclusion or a mention. Because of the timeline, that's not part of the story here. But if you're trying to understand, you know, the big picture, then it's worth knowing. I mentioned that this is kind of a lengthy book. It's, you know, 350 pages, and it does have some pictures. They're not great. They're black and white. They're copied pictures. And there's actually a whole section at the end of family photos, which is adorable. You know, like a little kid next to a basket press eating grapes out of the bin. And just like super cute stuff that you would expect to see from family photos and families growing up on a winery. And even though the quality is not great, the subject matter and the material is. And so you hear about this whole family throughout this entire book. And so it is really nice to put faces with names from their childhood when they were, you know, itty bitty children running wild in vines to grow people in the White House cellars because their wines were being poured at a state dinner at the White House. So it is nice to be able to put some faces with names, quality notwithstanding. So for my rating, well, if you couldn't tell, this book made me laugh. I learned, I loved it. I think this is a definite buy because I think this book hits several different things. One, it's just a memoir. It's a great story. It's an interesting story. And I think like some of the other books, some of the other memoirs that I maybe have reviewed in the past, you don't have to be in the wine trade or the wine industry to appreciate this book. It's very, very well written. It's illustrative. It's funny. It is well written. She tells a really good story. I mean, the subject matter is there. There's some really good material, but it's a good story. And I don't think that you have to be involved to appreciate it. That said, if you are involved in the wine trade, if you do like Oregon Pinot Noir, if you are a sommelier or someone studying for an exam, this is one of those books that I think is a way to reinforce what you know. It's almost like passive learning. I used to do this when I was studying for exams where my brain would just get really tired of like memorizing stuff and like making maps and flashcards and things like that. And so sometimes I would need to like rest. Well, this is how I thought about it. I would like need to rest my brain. And so I would watch, you know, a documentary or a movie about wine where it was factual. And so I could still engage that academic part of my brain, even if I wasn't actually studying. The same can happen with books. I mean, look, the history of the industry is laid out here with all of the heavy hitters and so much information that you wouldn't have just gotten if you were researching and trying to memorize your AVAs of, you know, the Willamette Valley or something like that. So it's good, like supplemental information, but it's also just a really great read. It's going to make you want to drink Pinot Noir. And also that's not a bad thing. So I think you should buy this book. I thought it was great. And it's so great to be back for season 3. I've got some great books coming at you for the season. So looking forward to it. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe. If you like what you heard, leave us a rating. See you next week. This episode was brought to you by Eldon Selections, an online Burgundy wine importer specializing in small production, hidden gem Burgundy wines, many of which are not otherwise available in the United States. Visit burgundywine.com/somme.